From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we begin our program by talking about tobacco use among young people, especially vaping. The FDA says 1 in 10 students, middle and high school, use tobacco products. And the overwhelming majority of those are vapes, e-cigarettes. They've been the most popular product for 10 years running, and cigarette and cigar use actually are at all-time lows. There have been a variety of efforts to deal with this from the state and federal government. A few years back, Illinois banned the sale of vaping products to people younger than 21. Indoor vaping was banned as of this year, and our senior U.S. Senator, Dick Durbin, has been riding the FTC to, quote, clear the market of unauthorized products, something for which he says the agency has blown multiple deadlines. We asked members of our texting group about this. Laura from Peoria says, "It'll always be a mystery to me as to why people are allowed to sell products to consumers that are known to be harmful and that can kill you. Just like cigarettes, I think people know some of the dangers of vaping, but how horrible can it be if the government is letting people sell this to us, right?" She continues, "I see a tremendous number of smoke shops when driving around. I don't get it." You can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. To talk more about all this, we are joined by Aaron Weiner. He is a PhD psychologist who specializes in addiction and has a practice in Lake Forest, Illinois. Aaron, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So I shared a bunch of sort of numbers and statistics to start with. What does this problem, though, actually look like to you on the ground, person by person?
Well, what it looks like is a lot of concerned parents and then also a lot of young people who don't necessarily know what they're getting into, where ultimately what they're trying to do, whenever you have a young person who is using a substance, nicotine, for example, or vaping, they're trying to accomplish a goal. It might be social acceptance, it might be dealing with anxiety, stress, pressure, which we know young people are under so much of these days. And they look to ways to solve those problems, and it seems like on face value that vaping might be a way to do it. It's flavored in nice ways, there might be certain peer groups that you can be part of and you can fit in with if you do that type of behavior. But the problem and the reason why I take an interest in it is that it's ultimately very harmful to them, and they don't necessarily go in with open eyes to make informed choices.
Okay, you talked about some of the reasons that young people take up vaping or smoking today. How is that different from what, you know, might have been the reason in generations past, right? We certainly don't see nearly as much smoking in movies or on TV shows. It's actually like something that's on a warning label now. On if you were watching a streaming show, it'll say, you know, contains violence, profanity, and smoking or something like that.
Yeah, well, and actually, interesting story about that. That smoking part got added on a couple years back because of how much smoking was in the show Stranger Things that was being watched by so many young people. And it was found that not only when kids watch people smoke on screen, they then are more likely to smoke, but also are more likely to vape. Because vaping right now is, for young people, what's seen as more edgy or cool or rebellious, which is something that's very common. And actually, I think that the trend here is less that things are different with vaping and more that they're exactly the same. And just like we had an industry that was creating Joe Camel and all sorts of predatory practices that cater towards young people, we now have an industry that's flavoring nicotine like cake, like berries, and really fighting tooth and nail to keep as many of these products on the shelves as possible, even though we know that when you put flavors in with nicotine, it disproportionately appeals to children. That's why we've banned flavored cigarettes in this country since 2009. So I'm not sure it's necessarily different. It's just changed clothes, and this industry that pushes out nicotine, pushes out tobacco, these addictive products, is just shifting along with the times.
All right, let's stick with young people. I want to come back to that idea of tobacco, sort of traditional tobacco, right? Burning leaves versus vaping and how some of those things are different. But I want to ask you about, you know, the sort of the environment in which young people are swimming these days, so to speak, right? And maybe you can talk a little bit about social media and how that relates to addiction.
Absolutely. Well, there was a study that came out, gosh, it might have been more like 18 months ago now, but it was looking at what percentage of posts on social media are positive or negative about different drugs. And to be honest with you, virtually everything that young people see on social media is pro-drug use for everything other than opioids. And even then, I think it was 40% of posts about opioids were positive, and using them recreationally, and 60 were negative. And so what they tend to see when they're looking on social media, not just are posts from people who might be looking for social validation about their behavior or like a permission structure to keep doing what they're doing, but they're also seeing influencers. And that was another element when you look particularly at vaping, and then again, even deeper, particularly at Juul. There was just a documentary released about this, where they actively went after this with the social media angle, with Instagram, with Snapchat, et cetera, because that's where the young people are. That's where they're consuming ideas and information. And so they hired folks to bring vaping into what is the popular lifestyle, to make it part of that zeitgeist. And here we are now, about a decade later, and we've got millions and millions of young people using nicotine when maybe they otherwise wouldn't have.
But it goes beyond just the content, right? We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago. We did an entire week on fentanyl. And we began with an author named Sam Quinones, who's written a couple of books on this. And in his most recent book, The Least of Us, he talks about how sort of Americans have been primed for other types of addiction, right? Gambling is one, social media is another. And just the way social media behaves and the way it works on our brains itself can be addicting, right? Do you see that as part of a sort of a puzzle piece here?
Oh, absolutely. I published an op-ed with a colleague of mine, Linda Richter, in the Chicago Tribune about 3 weeks ago now, talking about what's going on with advertising, particularly to young people, but this goes more broadly as well, around addictive fixes to problems that people are having. And absolutely, on the social media front, this is another one of these behaviors. Gambling being another one, of course, fentanyl. We could talk a long time about that. But where the idea being you're having some emotional problems, say, like you're feeling depressed or you're feeling anxious. And levels of these for everybody, but particularly amongst youth right now, are at record highs. And you want to feel better. Well, what if you could lose yourself? What if you could escape for hours at a time just swiping on TikTok and lose yourself in the videos? Or what if you could look at post after post on Instagram? This is effectively unlimited content that can assuage pain or sometimes even create pleasure. People like what they're looking at. The problem is that ultimately what we're seeing from studies is that there's ways of using it like that, where you're doing it for hours and hours at a time, or using it to cope with problems that end up hurting you on the back end because you're not actually coping with the problems. You're mostly just avoiding them.
All right, you mentioned young people are experiencing problems at all-time highs. We're going to talk a little later in the program on a different set of guests with a program that's going into the schools. But in preparing for that, I was reviewing some of the research about within the past decade, and I should say this was before the pandemic. So the decade before the pandemic, feelings of sadness and hopelessness were up double-digit percentage points among young people in that decade. So let's talk about that. What are people experiencing out there? What is happening that is driving those numbers?
Well, there's a number of factors, right? When you look at more existential concerns for young people in particular, the climate is a huge concern. School violence is a huge concern. There's a lot of political tension right now. There's a lot of economic tension right now. So there's a lot of things that are on their mind. And what we're finding from the National Youth Risk Behavior Survey is that one, basically half of teenagers right now are reporting that they have effectively what amounts to clinical depression. But perhaps even more concerning, one in five teens on this national survey endorsed making a suicide plan, thinking very seriously about suicide, and one in 10 actively attempting suicide in, I believe this data was looking at 2021. That's the most recent data that we have. But one in 10, that's absolutely astounding. And the adults, we could talk for a long time about this. It sounds like you have another segment. But the stat that sticks out most in my mind is that the American Psychological Association, they do a Stress in America survey every year. And a question that they asked in one of their more recent surveys was, how much would you agree or disagree with the statement, "Most days I'm so stressed that I can barely function"? And one in four adults said that this was true for them. And not only is that very difficult for the adults, but many of these adults are parents of kids. And so it creates this very stressed out, difficult, challenging ecosystem for kids to work through, and not necessarily then also equipped with healthy coping skills about how to manage it. And that's when they start turning to these more unhealthy ways.
And anytime the subject of suicide comes up, I will mention on the program again the number if you are feeling despair or thoughts of suicide, 988. Help is available. You can always call that number, 988. What is an adverse childhood experience? What does that phrase mean? And how does it relate to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so adverse childhood experiences, or they're called ACEs for short, are actually some of the most predictive experiences you can go through as a child in terms of really challenging or difficult outcomes later in life. Everything from cancer to smoking to depression. And essentially, what these are there's a traditional definition. There's 10 things that qualify, things that you might think of very off the top of your head, like abuse, physical, sexual, emotional abuse, but also very just challenging circumstances that you might go through as a child in your household, having a family member be incarcerated, having a family member have untreated mental illness, going through a divorce counts as an adverse childhood event as well for the children. And what we know is that the more of these ACEs that children go through, the greater the chances are that they're going to struggle. And again, these myriad different ways, in large part because they oftentimes have a level of stress as they go through them that then is chronic. It sticks with them. And when we're in a situation of chronic stress, there's a whole host of both biological and then psychological outcomes that come from that that don't bode well for our futures.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We're speaking with Aaron Weiner, a PhD psychologist who specializes in addiction and also speaks publicly about these topics. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. Today we are talking about vaping and what the Surgeon General has called an epidemic of vaping among young people. We got another text message. This one from Urbana, Illinois, says, "My 11-year-old granddaughter told us there's a kind of vaping product that is not harmful at all and made so kids can use it. She was trying to tell us there was no danger with this product. After we got over the shock, we tried to tell her that it sounded like a hoax. Not sure we got through. It was a scary moment." So, Aaron, the state, this is a few years old, but the state reported that 40% of high school students surveyed said there was low or no risk of people harming themselves using e-cigarettes. What are, in fact, the risks that come with e-cigarettes?
Oh man, yeah. Well, that's I guess just to react to the text message for a second. I mean, that right there is a perfect example of when we're talking about social media. So that girl heard that from somewhere, right? She didn't make that up. She heard that from somewhere. And I'd say it's less of a hoax and more something that's very intentional. And this actually makes me think about the first person who texted in, Laura, who was wondering why we do this to ourselves. Why are we selling things that are harmful? And I will answer your question in just a second. But the answer to that question is money. It all has to do with economics. And this has always been the pivot, whether or not we're talking about nicotine, smoking, vaping, alcohol, gambling, sports betting, all of it. It's this question about how much money do we want to make, and then are we being honest about the harms on the back end? In terms of what are the actual harms of vaping? So there's what we know right now, and then there's what we're going to find out in the future. Because vaping in its current form, it's only about 10 years old, and so we don't have the same wealth of information on it that we do, say, for tobacco. What I can tell you, though, was that there was a very compelling study that came out in a toxicology journal about 18 months ago. They did a scatter plot of all of the different compounds that you find in vaping aerosol. And I'm going to say vaping aerosol because it's not vapor. When we say vapor, we think of like water vapor. That's not what this is. These are chemicals suspended in air. And what they found is, depending on the brand, there's between 1,000 and 2,000 different chemicals that you are breathing into your lungs when you vape, most of which we actually don't know exactly what they are and exactly what they do. And these chemicals are created because whenever you vape something, it goes through what's called pyrolysis or thermal degradation, where whatever was there to begin with, which is, by the way, not regulated properly anyway, but what was there in the first place then breaks down into literally thousands of different other things. So there's the nicotine element where we know it affects the way that the young mind develops. There's behavioral consequences to this. Whenever the brain is still cooking and our brains aren't done developing until you're about 25, you really want to let it develop as naturally as possible. So there's the nicotine element, but then there's all of these unknowns in terms of carcinogens. There's heavy metals that we found in most vaping aerosols. Just a lot of very, very negative possibilities. And we don't know all the answers yet. We do know that compared to cigarettes, cigarettes are 7,000 chemicals on average that you're getting from a cigarette. So the 1 to 2,000 is less, but for young people in particular, less is not nothing. And that's still thousands of harmful things going into their lungs. And so that young girl, what we were hearing, right, is this narrative that like, this isn't harmful. This is fine for kids. This isn't a big deal. It is absolutely a big deal, particularly when you're still growing.
All right, we're going to take a break. We will continue our conversation with Dr. Aaron Weiner, PhD psychologist who specializes in addiction, has a practice in Lake Forest. We are talking about the epidemic in vaping among teenagers today on the program. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about tobacco use among young people. Cigarettes and cigar usage are actually at all-time lows, but vaping is the tobacco of choice now, or the, what would you say, nicotine delivery model of choice. 1 in 10 middle and high school students, according to the FDA, use tobacco products. The overwhelming majority of those are vapes. We are talking about this with Aaron Weiner, who is a psychologist specializing in addiction, has a practice in Lake Forest, also speaks publicly on these issues. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. So Aaron, talking about this nicotine use, how similar or different than what, you know, older generations, right? Gen X grew up, smoking was a lot more prevalent. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when you could, you know, people could smoke in restaurants and even on airplanes and things like that. What are the similarities? What are the differences in the sort of smoking and tobacco use environment for young people today?
Yeah. Well, so there's a few key differences, and it's part of what makes this so challenging with young people. The first is that we have a product that actually delivers a stronger nicotine hit than cigarettes do. And part of why they were formulated that way, purportedly at least, was that it would draw people away from cigarettes. But the problem is that then it's this even stronger chemical draw for young people. So that's one thing that's new. Another thing that's new is that it's actually much easier to hide and a lot easier to keep going and going and going. So these are devices that are very easy to conceal. It's part of why you see a lot of young people using them in school, hiding it from their parents. But they've also grown in their capacity and their potency over time. There was a study that came out maybe like 6 months ago that found that over the last 5 years, the strength of vape devices has on average increased by 3 times, the capacity up to 50 times as large as it used to be, and the price per milliliter is down 70%. So we're seeing as the industry kicks up, things get stronger and bigger and cheaper. And that means that unlike with cigarettes, where each cigarette is kind of an endpoint, I mean, you can chain smoke, of course, but there's kind of an endpoint there. You have to definitely have to go outside to do that. With vaping, you've got this strong hit. You have these tanks that contain so much nicotine, and you don't have to go outside. There's no endpoints. People sometimes just take them to bed. So there's a lot of elements to this that make it even harder to kick before we even get to the mango and the blueberry and the flavors that make the process of intaking the nicotine pleasant. Actually, when you talk to people who smoke, very few people actually enjoy a cigarette, and actually being mindful of the negative aversive taste is part of how we help people quit. So if you're taking that element out entirely and replacing it with something sweet and pleasant, that just makes it all that much harder to get off the nicotine down the line if that's what you want to do.
Well, let's talk about, is there a legitimate place for these products? What do you think of that industry argument that this is less harmful than, you know, burning tobacco for at least for adults?
Yeah, I think that there's very few people who would argue against that. I think that if you look at the amount of chemicals and toxins and tar in cigarettes and you compare that to vape devices, that there's very clearly a difference there. The problem is that there was a... So in this new documentary on Netflix called Big Vape, highly recommend anyone watch that. One of the architects behind the initial marketing campaign was saying, you can't have public health if no one buys your product. And when you start crossing capitalism and commercialism with an addictive product, whatever the idea behind it is, that's when things start to get really, really wiggly. And unfortunately, from the very beginning, these products were not framed in that way or created in that way. If you think about it, who could tolerate tobacco-flavored vapes? People who are using tobacco. Like that, we never had to go to all of these other places. And so, yes, there is a place potentially for someone switching entirely from smoking to vaping. However, final note about this, the studies we have right now for adults doing both, which is very common, people will be both smoking and vaping, is that those health outcomes are actually worse than if they were either just smoking or just vaping. So it's really tricky. And at this point, Pandora's box is open. I don't know if we could really roll things back at this point in that way.
All right, let's go to the phones. Nancy is calling from McChesney Park on line 4. Nancy, thank you for calling in.
Hi, Brian, and hi. I don't know the name of your guest.
It's Aaron.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Yeah, the problem with vaping is my daughter's ex-boyfriend used to vape, and he stopped because, you know, he finally came to the conclusion that it was costing him extra money, which he didn't want to spend. Usually it's a money factor with a lot of these teenagers and young adults, and also a health risk, which he weighed it out in his mind. He weighed it out and he said, no, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Was it easy for him to break that habit?
Yeah, he actually, it took him about 3 months and he doesn't vape anymore. And he's doing very well. He works for Amazon up in South Beloit, and he just can't. And plus he doesn't have the time to do it anymore.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Nancy. I appreciate that. Aaron, what do you say to a young person who does want to quit? How easy is it? How difficult is it? What are some of the strategies?
Well, it really depends on the person. And I'm so glad to hear, Nancy, that I think you said it was your daughter's ex-boyfriend, had such an easy time, because that's actually fairly rare. What we know from nicotine quit attempts, and again, this is with tobacco, is that the most successful group are actually younger people, but that's 1 in 10 people who are successful in their quit attempt. 1 in 10. And that success rate actually only goes down the older folks get, statistically speaking. Now, that being said, very few people actually use the tools that we have to help with this. So nicotine replacement therapy, for example, with patches or with lozenges, gum, that actually has been, it's FDA approved for a reason. There's other medications, and actually only 5% of folks use therapy. And we have smoking cessation therapies in addiction psychology as well that we can use to help people quit. What I would say, though, unless folks really just are amazingly strong in just willpower, which usually need a strategy. Willpower isn't enough. Is to make sure that you prepare, get some resources on your side, whether or not it's professional or literature, friends, because the hardest thing to make in terms of a behavioral change, it's so hard to do it on your own, winging it. And then particularly when you add in a chemical addiction, it's very challenging. So I'd encourage anybody to reach out to the supports that are there, and there are actually many.
So that's on an individual basis. What about from a policy standpoint, right? I mentioned in Illinois, you can no longer sell vapes to people younger than 21. Illinois just banned indoor vaping this year as of January 1st, although, you know, enforcement of that is another question, especially because, as you said, it's so much easier to hide than tobacco or cigarette smoke, for example. But what, from a policy standpoint, what else can be done?
Yeah, well, so Nancy was mentioning, thanks, Nancy, for the call. Nancy was mentioning how the economics make a huge difference. And that's something actually that we've seen very often. There's a lot of talk right now about an alcohol tax, because what we know is that when you make something more costly, people sometimes make the decision, hey, this is too costly of a habit, and I know it's not good for me anyway. And it's just that extra oomph to start to tip the scales in terms of how do we lower the percentage of people who are doing it. So the convenience of it in terms of cost is one, and then the access of it is another. Again, there's a reason why we don't sell flavored cigarettes, and it's because that makes them so much more accessible. That's also why we raise the age to 21, because that makes it harder for young people to get it. And that's the other element of this. Most people who start vaping right now are young people. They're in their teens, they're in their 20s. If you help folks get through that period of their life without developing a nicotine addiction, the chances that they start later on in life are exponentially lower. So we should really be looking at policies that make that they create friction. We want to create friction between someone wanting to do it or thinking they want to do it, and then being able to actually do it. So we can take the flavoring as much out of the equation as we can, as well as the nicotine out of the equation. And then, of course, there's just the flavors as a whole. Would be very supportive, much like we're talking about a menthol ban on menthol cigarettes. We really should not be doing fruity and candy flavors in with vaping devices. We've again known for decades that this disproportionately appeals to young people, and we just have to stop.
Aaron Weiner is an addiction psychologist based in Lake Forest, Illinois. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.